great pleasure to introduce our speaker today. And there's no need for very introduction. Carlo Rovelli is one of the founders of Groupon Gravity, and he worked on many other problems as well. Today he will tell us about cosmic rays from Planck stars, the quantum gravity calculation from A2Z.
Thank you very much, Wolfgang. That's the title, the quantum gravity calculation from A to Z. 30 years ago, so a long time ago, Lee Smalling and I were with a Bayashiker in a hotel room a little bit south of here in Syracuse, and we were excited. It was the early days of loops. And Abai was particularly happy and said, "Oh, great, now we can do something." And
all about timing.
I think I have to start again. Do you? So, replay. Please have a seat. 30 years ago, Lee Smalling and myself were in a hotel room with Abai Ashiker, and we were all excited. And Abai said, "Oh, great, now we can do things." And I remember, I don't know if you remember, Lee, we're in a hotel room. So I was sitting on the bed, and I said, "But, you know, maybe we have understood something that may work, I don't know. But from here to actual doing calculation in quantum gravity, A to Z, we have no idea how to do it. I mean, we don't have the observables, we don't have the scalar product, we don't know what physics are talking about. Maybe we have some solution with a Lewis equation, so what?" And Abai said, I remember distinctly, he said, "Hey, young man," you know how is Abai Ashik. "Hey, young man, it takes time to do things. Don't worry, things will." So 30 years have passed, and I think there is a way of doing a calculation from A to Z in quantum gravity, which is what I'm going to talk to you about. So the core here of the message is not so much black hole explodes. We can maybe see signals from the sky. Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe this is right, maybe this is wrong. There are some hypotheses that depend on many things. Maybe the theory is right. Maybe the theory is wrong. Maybe missing something essential. But this is a possible story in which you start from a full quantum theory of quantum gravity, you do full calculation, and you go down to an astrophysical prediction. Maybe it can be run in other ways, maybe through mistakes along the way, but this is a full story. So this is here I've written the papers where this story comes about, not the full theory. The full theory, a lot of people have contributed, many are sitting here. But the actual calculation is in a sequence of papers which are written here. One of these still has to appear, so one of the steps is not published and not certain yet. It's the last one, D'Ambrosio Christodoulou. I'll mention it with some caveats. The presentation is this, 7 points. They're brief, except a couple which are longer. I'll start with the presentation of the theory. So this is a calculation in a theory of quantum gravity. So I'll give you the theory, the full theory of quantum gravity, entire. I will explain what is the physical problem being addressed. Of course, we model the problem with a simple model. Setting up the calculation, computing the quantum amplitude, study the quantum amplitude to extract some scaling behavior of some variables, I'll show you, which leads to a prediction and leads to some astrophysical prediction, which is specific astrophysical predictions, which might be wrong, of course. It might be wrong if the theory is wrong, if the problem is badly posed, if the model is too brutal, it can be wrong for if we have done a mistake here, which is possible, we're not sure, or if some of the hypotheses of the model itself are wrong.
If the prediction is not verified, it doesn't rule out the theory.
We can talk about that at the end. I'm not, my worry here is not about how to test the theory. It's how to do a calculation of quantum gravity with all the problems, like the problem of time, the problem of observables, interpretation of quantum mechanics, how do we work without space and time, and all that. That's what I'm really
I'm asking that a lot. If it doesn't, I would call it a prediction.
You can call it the way you want. I didn't call it a prediction. I call it a calculation from A to Z in quantum gravity, okay? If you list, there's a long number of assumptions here, including the chaos or spherically symmetric and things like that. So.
I may add, so the presentation is for 1 hour, and we have half an hour.
Yes, so please do interrupt me if there are clarifications, but if you want to open a discussion, I think each one of these points, you can have a full discussion. Obviously, the first one, each one of them. But let's do, I'm happy to any discussion at the end. I see that there are a lot of people who are not sort of heavy practitioners of loop quantum gravity calculations here. So I think you will get a little bit lost in point one, because I don't want to explain loop quantum gravity. I want just to write the main equations rapidly. So don't worry if you get lost in point one, then this would make sense. And then in the actual calculation, just believe me that something happens, and then you will find me. So the people who are not in loop quantum gravity are going to be lost in a couple of points. But I think the entire story should stay together nevertheless. All right. So one, the theory. Now, the theory I'm talking about is covariant loop quantum gravity. That's the way I call it. You can call it differently. It's one of the versions of loop quantum gravity which is on the market. In particular, it's detailed in the book that Francesca and I have written. So this book on it with all the details. And it has been worked out by a number of people. Light? A red shock?
Red is harder.
No, this is no, that's worse. More light, not less. I write it stronger. Thank you. Thank you, Alex. So the theory is that better, Bianca? Thank you. So the theory has been worked out by a number of people. Many are here from the very beginning. Lee, Laurent is here, has a main contribution to the theory. And I'm not going to give any specific detail. I'm just tell you in the version we're using it, how it is defined. So the theory is defined by three objects, a Hilbert space, an algebra of observables, and transition amplitudes. And the Hilbert, so this is pretty standard for quantum theory. The Hilbert space is defined as a suitable limit. This, I don't go into the mathematics. I'll tell you what these gamma are. Of a family of Hilbert spaces, H gamma, attached to graphs. Gamma is a graph. So this is the evolution of the loops of loop quantum gravity. For each given graph, so a graph, just think this is a picture. It's not a graph embedded in any space-time. It's just a combinatorial relation between points, which are called nodes, and lines, which are called links. So for each one of these graphs, gamma, the Hilbert space is an L2 space, like very often in quantum mechanics, functions, square integral functions on SU2 to the L, L being the number of links, divided by SU2 to the N, N being the number of nodes. This means that essentially the wave functions here are functions of one SU2 group elements per each link. If you think about QCD on the lattice, that's what is going on, essentially. This is the Hilbert space. It's a family of Hilbert space. They sit into one another. This means that there's a gauge invariant at the nodes. It's exactly like QCD. The algebra of observables, it's a sort of a family of algebra of observables, one per each one of these lattices, which are related to one another. And inside there are two groups of observables. There is the HL themselves, like the x in the psi x representation in elementary quantum mechanics, and there are the other ones, which are the most important one. There are derivative operators, which is the standard left invariant vector field on SU2, the standard thing that one studies when one studies functions on a group. And these have a physical interpretation, which I'm not going into the details, but essentially, if you were doing lattice QCD, this would be the electric field operator, the standard electric field operator. The electric operator in the Aschinger formulation of generativity is a triad. So this is a triad. The square of that is a metric, essentially. It's a discretized version of the metric. And then there is the transition amplitudes, and the transition amplitudes also are defined as a limit in the same way in which you define transition amplitudes, a limit in perturbative QCD or in lattice QCD. Here's a limit, again, I skip the fancy mathematics, of some C going to infinity, where C is, so this is a loop, C is a two-complex. Two-complex is essentially a form, so there's something with vertices, edges, and faces, and each two complex has is bounded by a graph. So this is a node. This is a node of the graph. This is a link of the graph. And if you can think roughly this as a discretization of space, you can think this roughly a discretization of space-time. So this is a bunch of space. This is a bunch of space-time. Just you can think of the dual of a triangulation. So for each one of these C. There is an object, which is WC, okay, which gives an amplitude to these states. So if you want, is a bra, or a generalized bra, in the corresponding Hilbert space here, for a gamma, which is a boundary of C. And so you can express it as a function of the group variables on the boundary, and it's very simply defined. It's an integral over SU2, on many copies of FU2, one per each one per each copy vertex edge, delta function which glues all these SU2 elements around the face. So I take the multiplication of all this around the face. I call it HF. So the product of all the F. And then the product on all the vertices, this is the vertex amplitude, like in QD, you have a vertex amplitude where the things happen, the transition from a previous state to a, and you have an amplitude, which is a function of the H around it. And the explicit formula of the vertex amplitude, and this completes the definition of the theory, is the following. So given a vertex, its amplitude, it's a function of the boundary SU2 element. It is an integral of SL2C, Lorentz, of one SL2C element for each edge that comes out of it. So I call G the SL2C element. You don't have to remember any of that. I just want to write the formulas once and for all of covariant loop quantum gravity. So there's one SL2C element for each edge, and then there is the product on the faces. These are the faces around the edge of the sum of a j a spin from 0, 1 half, etc., to j plus 1. And then d, say in a moment what it is, dj mn of hl, well, this is the standard Wigner matrices of SU2 representation theory. HL is the group element which sits there, is out here. And it's the crucial element, D. Somebody's telling me you should have had the slides because. All right.
Where the quantum gravity solution
And so, as is clearly proven here, you see. can you please raise the screen?
Yeah, it's just slow.
Thank you. Okay, so the new object that appeared while it was is this one, which is the most important of all. This is a representation matrix of SL2C. These are SL2C matrices, okay? Unitary representations of SL2C, the infinite dimensional representation of a Lorentz group. J is the index summed over, M, N are the index summed here, J, J here, and gamma. So these are known objects that you can write in terms of things like that and integrals, one-dimensional integral of some exponential, some stuff. Okay, so this is completely, this is a theory.
Can you just review this whole setup? So your two complex.
The way you use it here, which is the simplest version of the theory, is actually the dual of a triangulation, the simplest possible way. The Polish school generalized it to more general complexes, two complexes.
So the cells and the complex.
So think the easiest way to think about it, it can be done much more generally. In fact, people like it more generally, but think of this as a dual of a four simplex, which is bound by five tetrahedra. These are tetrahedra, and these are triangles, the dual of the triangle. So that's one way of thinking about this. In the more general setting, this is if you want a different version of the theory, you can give a general two complex, so just a set of vertices, a graph plus a face being a sequence, an ordered sequence of.
And you, on the edges? I didn't understand. On the timelike edges, you have SL2C, and on the space-like ones, you have
On all edges, I have SL2C. I have SL2C on the edge. They're all time-like. In your,
they're all time-like.
So there's some incoming and some outgoing.
No, that thing across the top is not.
That's something else. Let me use some color codes. This is a graph. In red, and in white is so. Now this is the boundary graph. These are the nodes.
Yeah.
So the face itself is bounded by. If you cut a bubble, you have a graph on the boundary. That's the standard setting of the covariant, the spin form of formulation.
And the boundary.
On the boundary, you have SU2, which is that you're in the time gauge. In fact, I'll say that in a minute.
And you have something on the vertices also?
On the vertices, you have the no. The labels are only on the here and here. On the vertices, you have the amplitude, which is a function of the labels you have around it. It's like you have labels here, and you have the amplitude here, which is.
Just at the outset, I mean, well, you say it's going to be gravity. Is there anything, like, I look at this structure, I don't see any reason why I have to believe this is going to have anything to do with gravity at this stage of the game.
Yeah.
Apart from the fact you said the L.
Yeah, yeah. So let me say how do I use it and how it's connected to general relativity in a moment. So in fact, let me make two small. I want to stay on this blackboard to keep it. So first, how I use it, I'll do it here, and how it's connected to GR and what we know about this. The way I use it is the following. This describes a process, something that happens in some space-time region, say. This is quantum mechanics, so you have to think in terms of quantum mechanics. So choose your preferred interpretation of quantum mechanics. Let's say, for simplicity, Copenhagen, or relational interpretation that I like. You're outside. So you make measurement outside, and you want amplitude for this to happen. So on the boundary of the of the process, you have a state, an element here. This state, on the space state, there are the observables. And so the observables live here. So you can have a particular state, which is an eigenstate of some observables. And given a state all around, these formulas give you an amplitude for that process to happen. Let me write it psi like that, for that process to happen by just contracting this with this. Now, the observable themselves are interpreted. So how do you know that in QCD, QCD has the same observable? This is electric field, this is the connection. Well, by saying this is electric field, this is a connection, and when I go to the classical limit, I want to interpret this this way. Now, this is how I use it. What do I know about this is basically two main things. Two theorems, in fact. One theorem which says that, not exactly these equations, but they're analog of this equation with a cosmological constant, all the amplitudes are finite. So all the amplitudes are finite. And the second is that this vertex amplitude so theorem two, the vertex amplitude, let me say it loosely because I don't want into all the detail, is related to the exponential of the Regge action. Whose limit when in some sense is the Einstein-Hilbert action. So in fact, there's a bunch of theorems of this kind. There's a bunch of theorem of this kind. Some have been proven by Laurent Friedel here, some of these. So there is a limit in which this approximates an integral over discretized geometry given a boundary. I don't want to go into the full story of loop quantum gravity. So keep this on a side. This is the theorem using the, some specific equations. And now I want to use this to discuss a problem. And I'm happy in the discussion part to answer more questions about how this works. You'll see how it works in the in concrete, much better than in talking abstract. Number two is the following.
Are you saying that the vertex of your two complex corresponds in space time, say in the triangulation of space time, to simplex, and the amplitude you associate with it is just d to the I times the defect angle times
Area
of the two simplex.
Exactly. So the boundary, if you put on the boundary a state, a coherent state, whose geometrical interpretation, you have the E's and the S, whose geometrical interpretation is some discretized geometry, and you compute that quantity, then you get, in some appropriate h bar going to zero limit, the exponential of the Regge action of that particular geometry. Of course, if you do that with a Regge action, you get infinity in the Lorentzian case. This is finite. So there is a finite version of a discretization of the path integral, if you want. You can view it this way. It's a finite version of discretization of the path integral. So please let me move away, otherwise we spend 1 hour talking about how to think about loop quantum gravity. Of course, it's a huge, there are books on that. So let me now go to the physical problem. So the physical problem I want to understand, given that, in some version, I mean, you may like, dislike, doesn't matter. Given that theory, in some version, I want to know what happened to black holes. By black hole, meaning a collapsed object, a gravitationally collapsed object. A star that collapses, I want to know what happens then. Now, classical GR has a clear-cut answer. Namely, a black hole is stable. Once an horizon form, the horizon is a event horizon, it stays there forever. Quantum field theory on curved space-time teaches us that there is Hawking radiation, so slowly leaking of energy out of the black hole, then evaporates, and we don't know what's going to happen. Now, there can be a third possibility, which is so classically, a black hole is stable. Quantum field theory on curved space-time, we have the Hawking radiation phenomenon. There's a third possibility, which of course is not contemplated of that, of a non-perturbative quantum gravitational phenomenon. Okay? And This is very simple as a possibility a priori, then we have to study that in a concrete theory. If classically you put something in a box where it doesn't have enough energy to go out, it stays there forever, but quantum mechanically tunnels out. Atoms, stable atoms can tunnel out. So can a black hole tunnel out from its stable classical configuration? To do that, it has to violate the Einstein equations. That's fine, it's quantum mechanics. It has to take some time, and we'll compute how much is this time. And the phenomenon is tunneling. Tunneling is non-perturbative. It's proportional to 1 over h bar to some power. So I'm not going to see it perturbatively. So I cannot. It's a phenomenon that I cannot study with quantum field theory curve space-time. I cannot study with perturbative string theory. I cannot study perturbative effective generativity. I need a non-perturbative formulation of GR. So that's what I want to... quantum gravity tunnel. So here is a black hole in a sort of Penrose-Carter diagram. There is some matter that collapses. There's a horizon that forms. Classical general relativity tells us that there is a singularity here, which we interpret by saying we don't know what happens because this is quantum gravity. I want to know to say whether it is possible that the thing actually could tunnel out from this region. I need a blue. I need a yellow. Whether the matter could somehow tunnel out of some quantum gravitational region here. This is extremely vague. If I see it from here is a black hole, perhaps if I see it from here is a white hole. So that's, I want to study the possibility of this to happen. And to do that, I have to do a model. I'm already at the third point of this phenomenon and see if I can study it with this theory. So I'm going to do a model. And like all models, the first is based on some simplifications. So I list the simplification of the models. The first is that, you know the story, like all the cows of Canada are spherical and have a uniform flow of milk. Okay, so like all the cows of Canada, my black hole is spherically symmetric. Now, this is highly unrealistic, so nothing in the universe fails to, almost nothing in the universe doesn't rotate, okay? So this, I'm forgetting rotation. I have a spherical symmetric thing where the thing that comes in does not rotate. And the reason is that that's how I can do the calculation. Second, it's not very easy to describe matter falling in. It's not impossible, but it's not easy. There is something much easier to describe, which is a light in a thin shell. So I assume that the collapsing thin is thin null shell. Now, there is nothing unrealistic about light collapsing. Presumably, the early universe is a lot of photons, and there is a sufficient fluctuation they can collapse. But a thin shell collapsing is pretty unrealistic, right? Why should a thin shell? I mean, there could be many shells. But again, that's what I'm going to. So it's again unrealistic, but that's what I can do. Third hypothesis. All these are crucial for the actual calculation. I disregard dissipation. This is also unrealistic, okay? But somebody did great things disregarding, some Italian did great things disregarding dissipation, right? Galileo started figuring out mechanics and said, well, let's imagine that we forget friction. So let's forget friction, let's forget any sort of dissipation here, and let's try to copy Galileo, even if it's a little bit too ambitious. Now, if I disregard the dissipation, so in particular, I forget Hawking radiation, right? So Hawking radiation is a dissipative phenomenon, produces heat, I discuss this as a possible quantum tunneling in which there's no heat produced. Again, in the real universe, there will be heat produced. I'll think about it later. Now, there is a great advantage by disregarding dissipation, which is simple to see. If you take a ball, you let it go, it goes down, it bounces up, not at the same height. Okay? Why? Because it leaves some energy down in dissipation. But if there is dissipation, it bounces up to the same. If there is no dissipation, in the approximation, which you disregard dissipation, it bounces up the same, namely coming up. So all collisions are elastic. It bounces up is the same story of the world as going down, time reversed. So it's very tempting to start to study this phenomenon, assuming that it's time reversal, time t minus t invariant. So it's a bounce. The black hole bounces. Okay. So this means that what comes out, by assumption, under this, is the same as what comes in, sort of time reversed. And the last assumption, these are all very important. I assume that the phenomenon is dominated by its large degrees of freedom. By this, I mean the following thing. If I'm studying an atom, an uranium atom that tunnels out, what matters is the center of mass of the alpha particle or whatever, I don't know what's the decay of it. Not the degrees of freedom of the proton or the quarks or everything inside. So I assume, again, it's an assumption, that the actual physics here is not the very, very micro physics of what happened inside, but just a relatively large scale things. If I do that, then with all these assumptions,
isn't that last one implicit in the spherical
symmetry? Yes, assumption? Yes. I just don't want to. I wanted to list it separately because to avoid somebody who says, "Well, but you could do one without the other." But they are related. They're strictly related. In fact, it is. I'm disregarding smaller, but you'll see that in the calculation, in some sense, smaller degrees of freedom come in. Nevertheless. So I'm not saying there's only one degree of freedom. You'll see what happens. Now, here it's a very good technical result that comes in that allows all the rest to happen. And that's the first technical new point that I give you. It was in this paper. Under these assumptions, we know the metric outside entirely, and in fact, there is a metric outside entirely that realizes these assumptions. In other words, there is a solution of the Einstein equation, which is good here, 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 except in the quantum region, which describes this phenomena. This came as a surprise. You'll see in a moment why. So there is a quantum region here. Forget the quantum region. Outside, there is a solution of Einstein equation. What is the solution of Einstein equation? Well, it's not very complicated. This is an incoming shell. Inside the shell, you have Birkhoff, you have Minkowski. You have Minkowski here by symmetry. This is a symmetric shell, symmetric by Birkhoff. This is Schwarzschild for some mass, which is the mass of the shell. Now, good relativists say, no, come on, this is impossible. In fact, I see Raphael. Oh, you know. So why you would think this is impossible? Because this is an horizon, that's fine. Schwarzschild has an horizon. This is a maximum extension. Now I have matter anymore. I have light. I have a light ray that comes in. This is the horizon. Okay, and it comes in. So of course here the solution is very fine. The problem is that there's a white hole there. And in the maximum extension of Kruskal, there is a white hole, but it's down here, not after. So how the hell can this happen? Well, it does, and it is possible. That's pretty surprising. So let me say it precisely. You just have to assume that the metric here is a piece of Schwarzschild, and it is this piece of Schwarzschild. extended structure. Okay, so you have outside the shell, inside the black hole, you take this, you put it here, you time reverse, you put it here, and you have an exact solution of Einstein equations, which satisfy the Einstein equation everywhere. Here it does, right? We know that no shell can come in GR. The matching here, it's very simple, because the same metric and the sensor curvature is zero. So you're taking this, you're taking the time reversal of this, you can imagine, with a piece that come here, you open the two flaps, you put them there, and you get a solution of Einstein equations. So there is a solution of Einstein equations where all this happens, and the only thing we don't know is here. So now we want to study what happens here, knowing the metric before, knowing the metric after. It's a quantum gravity phenomenon. We're exactly in the scheme here. So the process here now is this one, this process. We know what is the quantum part is here, the classical part is there. You can use your relational, your whatever way you think about quantum mechanics. Outside is decoherence, whatever you want. You make a measurement here, you make a measurement here. What's the probability for the particle to tunnel out? Yes.
Just to clarify, you're choosing some minimum radius of the shell to collapse, right? You're not letting it go all the way to zero.
That's right. That's right. So I haven't yet told you what is this blue surface exactly. I have to put some point where I do the classical to quantum boundary, which is when the shell roughly is going to be when the energy density is Planckian, or before that.
But when you're matching, you've got to tell the matching the minimum radius of the shell, don't you?
The matching out here.
Well, that's fine. I mean, at the that little nodule, yeah, there.
Yeah. Well, I don't write a metric inside.
Not inside, but the way you draw the picture on the right means you've got to tell it that where those two points meet at the upper left, don't you?
This one, which is this, is going to match with upside. Is
it? It's the part that's inside. This one, yeah, that, right?
This
there.
One is not going to match with its time reversal, which is this, because in between there's a quantum thing.
Sure.
They don't meet. So there's a transition amplitude.
Where do you put that vertex on the upper
that's,
left?
That's what I'm trying to understand, that vertex. Where is that?
What we do in the paper is when the radius is such that the density becomes Planckian. So when we enter the quantum regime, I'll fix it in a moment. You will see in the equations in a moment.
The blue region is outside the horizon or is inside the blue region?
It has to leak outside. So if it doesn't leak outside, this is impossible, because if it doesn't leak outside, I can continue it to infinity, and I don't have the bounds.
So outside observer can see this quantum effects?
Sorry?
The blue region, outside observer can see the...
Of course. I mean, outside of
before
can be
the,
here.
Can
before be
here. The black hole happening.
Here. You're here.
No.
Oh, here. Wherever you want.
If you take to the right of the question.
Here. You can be here.
Right there. Right there is the future of that includes drive class.
Sorry?
The future of that point you just called R includes drive class.
Yes. That's right.
And a little bit of the blue curve as well.
The future
where that orange curve, the orange curve doesn't go all the way to R.
Is this answer?
Yes.
Okay. Now let's write a few equations, because so far has been picture. So the metric is spherically symmetric. All spherically symmetric metrics can be written in null coordinates, uv, and they're just determined by two functions. Function of uv that sits here, du dv, this is a standard null coordinates. And then a second function of uv, how do I write it, d omega square. The metric of the. So uv and rt null coordinate, so these coordinates here, right? D comes up here, u comes up here. Minkowski is very easy. So the easiest thing is to use U Minkowski, V Minkowski coordinate in the Minkowski region, U Schwarzschild, V Schwarzschild coordinate, and then match them. Minkowski is very easy. F is 1, R is whatever it has to be, U plus V divided by 2, the standard Minkowski. Schwarzschild, you just open any book, and F of UV is whatever it is, I don't write it wrong, 32 m square over r, I'll say in a moment what r is, e minus r over 2m, where r is determined implicitly. This function here is determined implicitly by these well-known things, r over 2m, e r over 2m is equal uv. Right? This is standard Kluskal thing that we teach students in general relativity. Now, this is a metric of Schwarzschild here. I have to say where this is, obviously, to match with the other. So there is a parameter here that enters, which is some value of v. Let me call it v0. Okay? There's a parameter in this story. And this v0 should be matched with a Minkowski v, one particular value of this Minkowski v. So I should have a matching condition, which is a relation between u on the v. So in other words, let me put it this way. The ray is v equal v0, or v Schwarzschild equal v0, and v Minkowski equals some value, which I can take to 0. Minkowski is invariant under. I have to match the two. I just do it explicitly, and I have a simple expression, which is u Schwarzschild as a function of u Minkowski is 1 over v0, 1 minus u Minkowski over 4m. I'll say in a moment why I'm doing these details, over 4m, Minkowski over 4m. Now, where is the geometry here? Where is the physics? What does v0 knows about? Well, to see what it knows about, let me give a simple interpretation. Take a line of constant radius, Schwarzschild radius, so size of the, it's going to be something like that. Okay? And I can compute the proper time along this line from here to here. I call it t, independent of the radius, tr. So this is a little exercise, a good problem that you can give your students. TR, do I have space there? No, I don't. TR, if you do the, it's just a standard exercise in Schwarzschild geometry. It turns out to be square root of 1 minus 2m over r. It's complicated. 2r minus 8m log v0 minus 4m. Log of r minus 2m over 2m. So this is the log of this. And I need a parenthesis. For large r, much larger than 2m, than m, this becomes 2r minus 8m log v0. So this tells me that I can define an object, let me call it t, which is a limit r going to 0 of tr minus 2r. And this is finite, and is this, t. And it has an obvious name, which is bounds time. So what's happening? Let's look at this in Schwarzschild coordinate, which is the simplest one. This is the horizon. You are at a distance r here. This is 2m. The shell comes in. So r is much, much larger than 2m. The shell comes in, is roughly at 45 degrees. But in Schwarzschild, it slows down, right? It does that. It never enters. In Schwarzschild coordinate, you never enter. At some point, there is the quantum region here that is leaking out the horizon. It keeps going up. It's time symmetric. And at some point, it comes out. Oops. Okay, from here to here is tr, the proper time, the distance r from when you go in. You take away 2r, and you call this bounce time. And this obviously is independent of R. So it's a time light get trapped there before bouncing out. Okay, you subtract the time to get there and to come back, and that's the bouncing time. The metric outside is completely determined by two parameters, V0 and M, or equivalently, M and T. This is the thing that we're interested in, the mass and the time it takes to bounce. That's the two things we're interested in. That's a model. Now I want to ask a physical question. Suppose this is happening in the universe, okay? Here you only know the mass, and classical generativity tells me what happens here. Classical generativity doesn't tell me what happens here, but T depends on what happens here somehow, okay? So quantum gravity should tell me what is T as a function of M. So that's the question I want to pose. What is going to be the time T as a function of M? Obviously, I'm not going to get a sharp answer because it's quantum mechanics. I'm going to get a distribution. This is going to be toggling, so there will be something in time. The probability of timing will be something like that. So the probability of time will go down, like, you know, and there will be some lifetime of the black hole, which is what I want to compute. Yes, Faye.
I'm just thinking about the dimensions of your bounce time.
There's g equal 1. G equal 1. There's no h bar yet, and everything is in g equal. There's g somewhere between. And actually, m has a radius here, so 2m is the radius of the thing. So everything has dimension. V is dimensionless. This is a mass, so it's a length in g equal 1. And this is a length in g equal 1. And this is a time, so c also equal 1. So I'm in c equal g equal 1. So I only think in terms of length.
Should we be thinking of the advanced time in units of structural gravity?
So in units of m, yeah. You're saying that there's an m inside here, if you want to have the dimension.
Well, u and v are units.
No, these are dimensionless. U and v are dimensionless.
Yeah, they're unitless quantities as defined there, but if you want to make them lengthwise, you've got to.
You should put an m. You're right.
Connect up to the structural definition.
That's right. I use that and never thought about it. Yes, that's right. So I cannot naively put this together with t equals with t is u plus t half. You're right. These don't go together. You're right. Thank you. Okay. So now it's a key point. So I'm almost at the point of the quantum amplitude, but I haven't told you where I put my blue surface yet, which is crucial. So to start the calculation, I have to choose a blue surface. I know that this classical metric goes wrong inside here because there is a singularity, R. So I have to put it around the singularity. If I put it too inside, it's wrong because it's quantum mechanics. If I put it too outside, I do useless thing. I won't put it. So now I want to choose the blue surface. So let me give it a name, sigma. Sigma is going to be my boundary between the quantum and the classical. It's going to be where the state is defined. It will have two parts, which I call B plus and B minus. Okay, they are going to meet on this point here, which is going to be a sphere. So B plus is a ball. Topologically, B minus is a ball. Topological. So these are two balls attached by a sphere. So it's a, the one-dimensional thing up with respect to this, right? So imagine you have two cup, the Jewish hat, and one up, one down, and the quantum transition is you take a Jewish cup and boop, you flip it the other side. That's what I'm trying to compute. The probability for a Jewish hat to flip the other side, and that's what I'm computing. Now, what makes the calculation possible, and in fact, a little technical thing that made everything possible, no, there's one point missing. T, it's a global. So TR, I sort of have to go here to see it. Can I see it locally, T? There's a little piece of geometry, which is better I say it now, otherwise one gets confused. Let's look at here. Let's look at the point where this line is on this Schwarzschild time here. So when the incoming shell crosses the surface of bouncing time. Okay, so if you continue the light, at some point it gets closer to the horizon. At some point it goes the other way. How close is it to the horizon? If you have the outgoing shell, it's also going to pass here. So this is an important point. Let me call it delta. I want to put this as close as delta as possible, but outside the horizon. So delta is going to sit here. On a key point. Now the radius of delta, let me call it 2m1 plus little delta. And it's easy to compute. You just have to write, to use basically this. So we are in t equals zero, so u is equal minus v. So I can do it here, one minus r over 2m, e r over 2m, minus v square. Because we are on t equals zero, we are on v zero. I want to compute r, but r, I write it 2m 1 plus delta. So 2m goes away here, 2m goes away here. 1 plus delta, this is, I get here 1 minus 1, so delta times 1 plus delta is equal to minus v squared. Delta is small. Delta minus is square root of v, zero. So in other words, t minus.
No,
but it's square
part.
Go like,
went too fast. Quadratic solved quite correctly.
No, delta is just
b
not the square. But delta is just
b not square. It's not square root b not.
Or
b
not
equals
root delta.
If you neglect delta squared, you got delta is b not squared, not root
b not. Oh, from here to here. Sorry, I just dropped this one.
Yeah. Delta is b not squared.
Oh, yeah. Delta is b not squared. Sorry. Thank you. It's just a two in the log at the moment. So t is minus 8m log v zero. So it's
4n.
Thank you. 4n log delta. So in other words, the actual position here of delta, this one, how far I am from the horizon, is what determines the bounce time. So all the information about the thing that I can measure outside is actually there. Obviously, it has to be there. Where else? Okay, it has to determine something else. So this is what we're going to use. So now I'm going to put my blue surface sort of as close as possible to delta. I could derive delta, but I have to choose it. How do I choose the blue surface? Well, I use the Lemaître time. The Lemaître time is a Panleve time. It's the, I don't know if you have looked at these coordinates. It's the coordinates here, Fata coordinates here and here, which, in terms of which, so you can write it just as a function of T Schwarzschild, R Schwarzschild. I can even write it down, even if it's not particularly illuminating. More interesting what one does with it. Here it is. So it's T Schwarzschild plus 2 square root of 2n R Schwarzschild plus 2n logarithm. It's Lemaître that came out with this. Square root of Rs over 2n minus 1 square root of Rs over 2n plus 1. The advantage of this time is that in terms of this time and a coordinate R defined by R Schwarzschild cube is 9n over 2r minus t, t being this one. In terms of these coordinates, the Schwarzschild metric is in the time gauge, and it has an incredibly simple formula. So that's a Schwarzschild metric in this coordinate. If you want to work in quantum gravity, use this because it's incredibly simple. So this is a Schwarzschild matrix in terms of the Lemaître coordinates, where Rs is given a function of R by this. Okay. This is a, it's like that. There's a blue. Something like that. Let me not draw it there, so I don't want to confuse everybody. This is the t equal constant slices. So this gives me t equal constant fixes a slice, which I call, which I decided to be my b plus, which I know explicitly the geometry of that. I know the full metric, how it changes about in time. And in terms of this time and this radius, I am in the time gauge. So I have no Lapsical one and shift to equal zero, which is the one in which the theory is implicitly written there. There's no laps and shifts there. There's nothing. I have only the three metric evolving in terms of time. Now, B plus is simple. There's a simple calculation from here, which I don't do because I don't want to waste time. It's flat. The intrinsic geometry is flat. And the extrinsic curvature, KAB, can be computed just from this change of coordinates. And it's a simple calculation. Is 2n 3 half R Schwarzschild minus 5 half dr square minus square root of amrs d omega square. Now, this is confusing because it seems that no information about time, about t, is there. So where is the information about t? Where is the information about that? Well, the information about t is here. If you look at the angle, the boost angle, between this and what is going to be b minus, or equivalently, between this and between this surface and this surface. So this surface has its normal, which is in this direction. So if you look at this angle here, we call it z0 half, because it's sort of half, we need twice of that. if you compute it, which is very easy, you just take the scalar product between dt and dts normalized, you find out which is exactly logarithm delta. So z0 half is minus logarithm of delta, which is t over 2m. I'm off by a 2 for m. So where is the information about the bouncing time in these coordinates? In the angle there. It's completely contained in the angle there. Now everything, I can do the quantum calculation. I can set up the quantum calculation and study how t depends on m. So how do I set up the calculation? I use the structure here. That structure here gives me amplitudes. I want the amplitude. The amplitude is going to be a function of the state. The state is going to be determined by the geometry. The geometry depends only on m and t. So the amplitude is going to be a function of m and t. Okay? And from the shape of the amplitude, so how it scales with m, I'm going to fish out the lifetime. So let me do it without giving you all the full things, but just telling you the kind of things that happen. I'm going to keep that. So what I need to do is to only... constant Lemaitre time fixes the surface, which I'm going to take as boundary between quantum and classical. I have the intrinsic geometry of this, the extrinsic geometry of this, so I can write a quirent state in my quantum theory of gravity that correspond to this classical geometry. I can put it on the boundary, evaluate the amplitude, and the amplitude is just going to be a function of t and m, nothing else. Given this choice, this approximation, and all the rest. So how do I do it? Because I have to go down to a sufficiently small number of degrees of freedom that I can treat it, and sufficiently large that I don't get nonsense. So I take b minus, for instance, and then b plus, and then the same with b minus, and I discretize it. So I do a triangulation of it. B minus is a ball. The simplest way of discretizing it is just a single tetrahedron, but that's too simple. I take four tetrahedra. So in the dual, these are my four tetrahedra. They all attach to one another. And they have one triangle outside. This is B plus. Same B minus, so the lowest sphere. I discretize it with four tetrahedra, and I glue them. This line represents the four triangles, which discretize this surface here, which is just outside the horizon. Okay, so this is going to be gamma. And now we want to compute the amplitude. And of course, I do it to lowest order in this expansion here. So I put the lowest thing I can put inside. And the lowest thing you can put inside is pretty easy. How do you go from four tetrahedra down to four tetrahedra up? Well, you put a four simplex, just five tetrahedra. Four, one is sticking up. Another four simplex, one is sticking down. You glue them, and you have two four simplexes. So you have one vertex here, one vertex here, four edges down, one edges up, four edges up. Okay, this is my, there are faces here. There's a face here, face between any of these, a face here, four faces. Around this, there is this figure here, right? This end up in the nodes. And this end up in nodes. And I glue this. I glue this. So this is going to be my two complex. Vertex, edges, faces. This is going to be my boundary graph. And what I have to do is to, this is gamma, so I know what is a Hilbert space associated to gamma. I have just to find out in the Hilbert space an appropriate state such that its approximate geometry, intrinsic and extrinsic, is the one written here. It's flat with this extrinsic geometry here, okay? And where is t gonna be here? You see, on the faces, what is extrinsic geometry in the discrete? Is the angle between two things. So on the boundary, on these lines here, which are the discretization of the triangles on delta, the b and the lowest b and the upper b join with an angle, a booster, which is given by this, which knows about t. Okay, so I I now write down the coherent state in that Hilbert space that corresponds to the geometry. The geometry, I know it exactly because I can take that geometry there, triangulate. I have I put four tetrahedra, four flat tetrahedra. I know the area of the faces. I know the angles between them. I know everything. I discretize this continuous curvature in terms of discrete curvature where the tetrahedra join, okay? And I have, there is a full theory in that Hilbert space, which was developed by many people, including Laurent Friedel here, of writing this Hilbert space. I don't know, it's probably not worthwhile that I go into details because very few people here go into the details of loop quantum gravity, but there's a standard, like you do wave packets, like you do psi x0 p0 of x is equal e minus x minus x0 square over 2 sigma ei p0 x, right? This is a wave packet which is centered on this x0 p0. So the same, you can do wave packets in the other space which is centered on some intrinsic extrinsic curvature. You write explicitly states, it's heavy. It's heavy because you have 1, 2, 3, 4 states of one kind, 6 plus 6, 12 of the other kind. You put everything together. So the state here is going to be function of one group element for each one of these red lines. So 4 group elements here and 16 group elements there. And you can write this explicitly. And this only depends on m and t. And then you use this expression here, which is function of the same variable, w, which is a function of the same variable. You contract the two with the SU2 product, and you get to a w, which only depends on m and t, which is just a bunch of SU2 SL2C integrals and sum over j's of a complicated expression, which take a page and a half. And you're here. I was hoping to write all the equation explicitly, but I think I'm going to kill you if I write the equation explicitly. So I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it. And I go to the end, scaling prediction in astrophysics. So I look at this expression. It's long and complicated, but I notice that it has this following form. It's a sum over j of some function over j, which is going to be very complicated, but t is the key quantity, t and m, t is the key quantity, comes out very easy as I t over 4m j. And let me write it, let me take it explicitly. This is j minus j0 square over some sigma, where j0 is 2m. Now there is h bar, eh? Now there is h bar. So now we're in Planck unit. So j0, the spin that comes in this sum here, j0 here, the sum here, the representation of SE2 is the eigenvalue of the area. So it's what labels how big are the things I'm considering my sum of the geometries. So Now I can do the following thing. I can say, this seems to vary little in J. This is a Gaussian around this value. Let me do a super brutal approximation and just replace this with, brutal approximation, replace the sum of a J by putting J equal J zero. If I do that, T comes out. When I take the modulus square, big T disappears. This is independent of time. It means that my amplitude here cannot go down. So in order to be normalized, I have to be very small. And so it means that tau is infinite. So in this horribly brutal approximation, the lifetime of the black hole is infinite. Fine. So next approximation, let me just sum over the 2j around it. So then w is going to be something like this common factor here, I t over 4m.
I don't understand what you just did. Did you take this, is that graph showing the square of the amplitude of the
square? This is the square of the amplitude normalized with some n that I don't know as a function of t for a fixed m.
Okay. And you're saying that it's
I'm not.
The mean, you're saying the mean of that is infinite. Is that what you're saying?
Let me do it this way. I don't know the normalization. So I suppose I want to find tau from just a couple of points here.
Right.
I can take w at some value t bar minus w0, divide w0 for the normalization. This is proportional to tau. If you plug, if you think that this is minus t over tau, 1 over tau, if you plug this here, you extract tau. Okay? You see? So from the slope of it, you can, from how you come down, you can get, you can write, you can get tau. So if you, if it's independent of tau, this is zero, tau is infinite.
Well, we can discuss later, but
Okay. Let me say something. Up to writing this complicated formula, I'm just using my theory. Now I'm heavily trying to look through this formula what can happen by making additional assumptions, including this exponential decay, right? This is in addition, if this was so. So let me get to the end, because I'm close to the end. So the next two terms are J 1/2 and plus and minus 1/2. So I half t over 4m plus e minus I half t over 4m. This is a cosine. So the what I get here.
The absent sigma term is what happens to me.
The sigma?
Or the exponential. Yeah, the Gaussian thing. That's got to be there, right?
Right, so the, yes, so sigma we can estimate it exactly from the like here. You want the sigma that of a coherent state. So sigma is much larger than 1/2. Sigma goes square root of j zero. So the correction here is small. That's approximately one when you are at
the f of j.
So the f of j is the part we control less. We think we're convinced that this varies little in this region here. In fact, I'm not going into detail. Let me grant me this.
You have to add up a lot of them to actually.
Yes. Then I go to the next. So here you get something a plus t square over m square, a plus b, something proportional to that. You take this, you plug it there, and you get tau proportional to m square. Now, if you add next terms, other terms, what happens if you get subdominant terms here? I don't have time to show that. So I'm using a lot of my time. So let me rush to the final part, and then we can discuss that. Sorry for being a bit. I need a new blackboard. Which one I use? So final part. let me believe that this wave handage is correct and T is M squared. Then I have two results, strong, in my opinion, which are the following.
Is that T for the one from the M squared?
The average time, the lifetime.
It just looks like a J.
Sorry, I always write tau the wrong way.
So, Carl, just to summarize.
Can we do the discussion? I need 5 minutes, otherwise that opens up infinitely. Let me finish, and then we do the discussion before summarizing.
I was trying to help.
let me finish. So let me go to the punchline, and then. So first of all, this obviously is in Planck units. So if I put the Planck units, this is proportional to some numbers, which I hope is small, G3 H bar over C to the 7 M square. You see that H bar is downstairs as we expected. Now, tau is going to be long for every N. Let me say, what about tau being the Hubble time? So if there's some black hole that on the average are exploding now, which were formed in the primordial universe, what would be the mass? I put the mass inside, and the mass comes out 10 to the 23 kilograms, which means 0.1 the mass of the Earth, which gives you immediately the Schwarzschild radius of these black holes here is 0.1 a centimeter, because that centimeter is the Schwarzschild radius of the Earth. So there is a prediction here, in quote, it's a very vague prediction. So not in any sense you were mentioning in the first question I got, which is there would be a lambda emitted. Yes.
Earth mass.
So here is the story, and here is an interesting part of the story. Suppose we do observe strong signals, one or two order of magnitudes within that, which are the fast radio burst. That was what excited us at the beginning. But that's not the interesting part of the story. The interesting part of the story is the following. Suppose the story is true. For the story to be true, you need to believe the theory, believe the scaling, believe the model, believe that there are primordial black holes, believe a lot of things, each of which can be wrong. But suppose it's true. Then imagine that there is a black hole exploding far away. If it explodes far away, you don't see the emitted wavelength because there is a red shift. And the standard redshift, as a function of the distance, things which are more far away are redshifted in a way that everybody who is taking a cosmology class can compute. But if this object is exploding far away at a cosmological distance, time has passed for light to get to us, so it will explode in the past. It's exploding in the past, his lifetime has better be smaller. So it's more likely to be a smaller black hole. If the smaller black hole, its wavelength emitted is smaller, right? So we are going to see this extra phenomenon folded up with a redshift. So we are going to see a flattened redshift. And this can be computed. It's not complicated. We have the explicit function for this on this hypothesis here. So the prediction is that either the fast radio burst or corresponding high energy gamma rays, which Francesca has talked about here a week ago, because there's the stuff that comes out, are going to be seen with a dependence on the distance, which is not the standard redshift, but a flattened redshift curve. And that would say this phenomenon, it's a exploding black hole, because we cannot think anything else that would have a flattened redshift like that. So here's a story. This needs to be done much better. The calculation can be improved, the approximation can be improved, but there is a theory, there is a model, there is a quantum gravity prediction from which you get a certain idea of the possible phenomenon, exploding black holes, certain idea of the time it takes. If you fold in the hypothesis that there are primordial black holes, you get to an astrophysical phenomenon that might be a possible explanation. There are other explanations for something already observed, but most importantly, it's going to be clearly separated with sufficient statistic from any other thing you see in the sky, because there's a very peculiar flattening of the redshift. Sorry for taking long.